It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Howdy, everybody. CJ here, and welcome to episode, I believe it's 237 of the Dangerous History Podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to be having a conversation with Matt Alford and Tom Secker, who are two of the main researchers and two of the producers of the 2022 documentary film Theaters of War. Now, those of you who've listened to my podcast for a while are probably familiar with Tom and his work over at spyculture.com, where he focuses on researching and exposing the degree to which U.S. government institutions like the Defense Department and the CIA and so forth have penetrated and continue to influence and even exert direct control in some cases on major TV and movie productions. And you may remember I had him on this podcast several years ago to discuss the book that he co-authored with our other guest today, Matt Alford, which was called National Security Cinema. Well, Tom and Matt have continued their research. They've uncovered all sorts of new things beyond just all the stuff that they exposed in National Security Cinema, and they were able to work with some other great folks to put together this documentary film, which I highly recommend. Even if you've read National Security Cinema, this is worth watching because, like I said, they've uncovered a whole bunch of stuff that they didn't have access to in the years since they published National Security Cinema. And furthermore, a lot of people are going to, you know, respond better to a film than to reading a book, let's just be honest. And they really got some pretty cool stuff in the film, including Roger Stahl, the narrator, and I believe the executive producer of the film, even had a chance to speak with Oliver Stone a little bit, which is cool. So anyway, I highly recommend the film, and I hope you enjoy our discussion here. And then one other thing that I'll mention before we switch over to the conversation is that as I'm recording this intro, yesterday, around noonish, my Indiegogo campaign to liberate me from my day job busted through 100% funded, and as of this recording, I am 105% funded. So I'm actually a little bit above $12,600 with 5 days still left to go on the campaign. And yes, I do get, you know, minus Indiegogo's fees, which are, you know, pretty small, actually. I do get whatever else is raised beyond the 12,000 goal. So please feel free. The campaign has 5 days left. And I think I also have the option to extend it a few more days beyond the original deadline if I wish, and I probably will, just because I could use every penny I could get. I'm really, taking a leap of faith here in a lot of ways. So I would urge you, if you haven't yet contributed and, you know, have been considering doing so, please do so. This is, you know, still a terrifying thing for me. Yesterday afternoon, I submitted via email a resignation notice at the college that I've worked at for 15 years. And so this is a very complicated emotional time for me right now, where on the one hand, I'm relieved to be leaving a job that I was increasingly disillusioned with, to put it mildly, and to be starting new projects and expanding, you know, projects I've already been doing for a while, like the Dangerous History Podcast itself. And so, you know, I've got this relief and exhilaration, but also this fear of, you know, leaving a steady paycheck I've been at for 15 years, and the benefits of that probably are the most scary thing to be giving up. So please, if you're willing and able, continue to chip in to the Indiegogo. And also, you know, you get the perks there as well. In addition to that, I would just say now more than ever, please consider signing up to support the show on a regular basis via places like Patreon and Subscribestar. You can also, if you just want to send in a direct PayPal donation, you can do that. Go to profcj.org/donate. And in addition to that, I do have a Bitcoin address on there if you want to contribute via Bitcoin. So I really could use all the help and support I could get right now in these coming months as I make the transition to being full-time self-employed and self-directed. All right, so here we go. Here's my conversation with Matt Alford and Tom Secker, both talking with me on the Zoom all the way from the UK. So hope you enjoy.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right, guys, thanks for coming on the show today.
That's our pleasure. Hello.
Howdy. Okay, so I've had Tom on my show a few years back when National Security Cinema came out, or not long after it came out, I think. And Matt, you were Tom's co-author on that book, right?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So I know a bit about Tom's background, but I'm curious, Matt, you're actually like in academia, right? What's your sort of background and how did you get into this sort of work?
I did a PhD, which applied Noam Chomsky's propaganda model to Hollywood cinema. And then following that, I published a book and numerous academic articles in journals, and then kind of came to the end of the sort of run on that. I'd done degrees in history and politics and film and television, and then I did this kind of theoretical application of Chomsky's anarchist ideas, and then I got to around about something like 2013 and was a bit like, kind of don't really want to do any of this anymore. I feel like I've said everything I want to say. But then I met Tom, and we decided to do all these Freedom of Information Act requests, and found an enormous amount of documentation that had previously been really quite well hidden by the Department of Defense and CIA. And then Tom found out even more from the FBI and NSA and various police departments, all pointing to various fairly covert levels of state control and militarized and securitized state control over the entertainment industry. So that kind of gave my research career, sort of academic career, a kind of second second breath of air, really. Breath of wind? Sounds a bit gross, doesn't it? A breath of air? You know what I'm saying. and that's so we've carried on doing that since, me and Tom. Obviously, Tom leading on the Freedom of Information Act request side of things. And then it's led to the creation of this documentary, which has been executive produced and led by another brilliant researcher, Roger Stahl, in the States, sort of doing a sort of road trip around America, tying down further these documents, but then also interviewing army veterans and things like that about the kind of consequences of all this, and then putting it into a very entertaining film. So that's kind of where I'm up to, is being a a co-producer on this documentary with Tom and Roger, and very, very proud of the work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the documentary is really good. I actually watched it with my younger child, who is very, very interested in movie and television production, and is actually, you know, through school doing things like set design and whatever. And so is very interesting, very interested in media. And I've talked to her a little bit about, you know, the ways in which the stuff we're going to be talking about today, the stuff the documentary digs into. So I can say not only did the documentary interest me very much, but, you know, even my 13-year-old kid found it really, really interesting. By the way, Matt, your PhD dissertation sounds very interesting. Chomsky's propaganda model applied to film. I'm actually in the middle of rereading for the first time in a bunch of years since I last read it, Manufacturing Consent. And it's interesting, you know, obviously a lot of the specifics of what he talks about there is very dated because the book was written 30 some odd years ago. But man, so much of like the big picture points in that book are, you know, just as valid today, if not more so, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, there's been an increased concentration of media ownership that particularly happened in the 1990s after the book was published in 1998, which did sort of enhance the applicability of the propaganda model to understanding the media. Although there's something really interesting. I won't get off too far into the Chomsky things right now, because I imagine you want to talk about other things. But it's quite interesting. I was speaking to some students just a few weeks ago, and I think because of the rise of things like Netflix and the ability to acquire any piece of information at any time, I think that among young people, and this is not to have a go at young people, but it's just, I think there's an ignorance of the actual importance of that of that way of looking at the media. Because the idea now is that everything's so decentralized, you can find anything on the internet. Everyone's making their own content. Even I'm on TikTok, you know. So, you know, how can there even be a mainstream? How can there be a mainstream media? And so it's very easy for people to not think that there is, because they, with a, you know, a touch of a button, they can do whatever they like and find whatever they like. But the thing is that what they don't get, because it's quite a hard idea to get into your head, is that there is nevertheless still a mainstream, and that all of these companies are, you know, these corporate entities which are very much tied to state interests and often to military interests and so on. And so that means that there is a mainstream. There simply is a mainstream. It's just it's not as easy to see as it was, say, in 1995 when Rupert Murdoch was taking over a bunch of satellite channels, and the Telecommunications Act was allowing for the monopolization of everything under Clinton. And, you know, it was more obvious then, but less so now. But it's still the same phenomenon, if not worse.
Yeah. Tom, anything you want to add in terms of like how this project came together, you know, how your prior work kind of led you to be involved with making this documentary?
Well, I mean, I guess the simple story is essentially the one that Matt just told. I mean, we wrote the book. It came out just over 5 years ago now. That 5 years has gone very quickly, I have to say. I mean, in some ways slowly, but in other ways very quickly. And I can't remember exactly when it was, maybe 8-10 months after we published the book. Roger approached us. And at that point, the idea was maybe to do kind of just a documentary version of National Security Cinema. But in the three and a half years we spent actually developing and producing this thing, and poor Roger doing so many different edits of this documentary in response to Matt and my sort of endless notes and suggestions and requests and so on, it became a very different film. And I think this hasn't just been the process of making a documentary. We've all learned an enormous amount in the course of making it. You know, there's so much more documentation available. There's so many more like big and broad themes coming out of this, if you know what I mean. Things that we had an inkling of before, say about sex crimes in the military, mental health in the military, themes like that, that you wouldn't necessarily think this is something the Pentagon has a like really big influence on in both film and TV. You wouldn't have thought these issues were that high up on their agenda, but they are. And so we can map things like the Pentagon's influence on the depiction of nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons policy. We can map that basically from World War II to the present now because of all this additional information that we have. And then trying to condense that down into a documentary format was, you know, at times a bit difficult. There is a lot of stuff that left that ended up on the cutting room floor. There's a lot of stuff we just had to leave out. But that is what it is.
Any possibility of like a special edition with deleted scenes or a director's cut or something to include some of the stuff that didn't make it in the final cut?
Well, I do have all of those original cuts somewhere on my hard drive. So, I mean, if people want to see a like 2 hour, maybe 2.5 hour version of this that isn't particularly well polished and things, then I guess they can email me and maybe we can sort something out. I mean, no, at this point, we're not really thinking in those terms. We're thinking, like, how can we get this wider distribution? That's what we're really focused on right now, is how can we get this out to as many people as possible? Because so far, it's been doing very well on Canopy, which is the, like, educational streaming service, I guess. So there's clearly interest in it. There's clearly a market for it. And so we're just trying to figure out, you know, in terms of film festivals, in terms of trying to get in contact with distributors, or at least getting MEF to get in contact with distributors and all that kind of thing. We're not really thinking about additional. I don't want to go back to Roger and say, let's recut the movie again.
Gotcha. I was just curious, you know, because when I watched the film, I was like, oh, that was great. But there must have been all kinds of other cool stuff that just didn't make it because of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for dorks like me who are really into this stuff. So, let's take a step back and sort of zoom the lens out, and whichever of you two wants to take a stab at this. Basically, to someone who has little to no familiarity with all the stuff that you guys have researched, how would you describe what these entertainment liaison offices are and kind of what they do, and like what sort of, as the film puts it, what's the deal that they offer to people who are involved in producing movies and television shows?
Matt, do you want to run at that one or should I?
Happy to, as you've asked. I would put it like this, or at least this is the point that we're trying to get across. We think it's a really unhealthy and really quite insidious and deep-rooted problem within American society, because although these are basically just PR organizations, they are PR organizations within some of the most dangerous, volatile, violent organizations that have ever existed on the planet, namely the American military. And that's not to make a dig at American military, American servicemen, nor to say that the American Army, Navy and Air Force is more unethical than any other previous violent organization going back millennia. But nevertheless, it is an organization which has the most tremendous weapons at its disposal and has shown over a period of decades and indeed centuries the capacity and willingness to use those weapons. That doesn't mean that those organizations and the CIA are uniquely bad or anything like that. But it does mean that there's an awesome responsibility for those organizations to conduct themselves appropriately. And I think the majority of people around the world would consider the way that the American military machine has conducted itself for a long period of time to not be appropriate. And now these PR organizations within those entities are spinning the image extremely effectively on many thousands of Hollywood film scripts and TV computer games, and meaning that the entire representation of American securitized and militarized power has been scrubbed of anything controversial and indeed is very actively promoting talking points that that are designed to sell weapons, to showcase new military hardware. And this has been done pretty as secretly as any company operates. So we think that that's a really dangerous thing to do, in the same way as it would be a very dangerous thing to do if there were a comparable propaganda outlet based in Moscow that had that sort of impact over the Russian military. But all the more dangerous because the United States is so much more powerful than any other nation.
Do you want me to take a run at that as well?
Yeah, if you have anything to add, for sure.
Well, from a different angle, at its simplest, it's about access in exchange for control over content. That these film and TV producers, video game producers, whatever else, they need access to stuff, whether that's people, locations, equipment, just information and knowledge a lot of the time, in order to make their products more compelling and more engaging and seem more realistic, or at least build a plausible world that people can easily fall into for the purposes of entertainment. So they need that access. And what they give up in control in exchange for that access is control over their content. It's control over what they can and cannot say. And I mean, it's everything from little lines of dialogue that accidentally reference a horrible Vietnam War era chemical weapons program in a Hulk movie, all the way through to the overall story and character arcs in The Last Ship, that Michael Bay, very popular cable TV show produced by Michael Bay. You know, it's everything from the micro to the macro. And so as a result, it's everything that Matt just said. It's that you have these very violent, very dangerous organizations with a pretty horrific track record of doing brutally horrible things. Certainly not the only ones in the world doing them, but whatever. They're the only ones that have this kind of influence over a product like Hollywood, which not only shapes what people think, the kinds of opinions or ideologies they might subscribe to and things like that, but it shapes how they feel. You know, Hollywood is giving us all of these little emotional trigger points, all of this shaping of our entire psychological way of life. And that's far more powerful than any news broadcast could be, or any magazine articles, or anything like that, anything in the information realm. This is about something deeper. This is about how people feel. And Hollywood tells us how to feel. And skulking in the background, the CIA, the FBI, Homeland Security, LAPD, and all the rest of them are telling us how to feel about them. At its simplest, that's what this is.
What do these entertainment liaison offices claim are their primary purposes versus what are their apparent real purposes, kind of based on what their behavior and the empirical evidence that you guys have uncovered? You know, because this is something I see so often, not just in regard to the military and intelligence and law enforcement agencies of the government, but even, you know, things like, what's the Federal Reserve really for, right? What's the Department of Agriculture really for? It seems that inevitably there's this regulatory capture phenomenon going on with these sorts of things when you're talking about regulatory agencies anyway. And, you know, you've got the stated public purpose of what these things are supposed to be doing. And then you've got what they're actually doing, what they're actually for, whose interest they're actually serving. So in terms of specifics, like what specific things, if you went, you know, and asked Phil Strub or his replacements or whatever, you know, what their office is supposed to be doing and what they see their mission as versus what the documentation, the actual evidence reveals they're really up to.
Well, can I take the CIA as the example rather than the military?
Sure.
Okay, so the CIA pretend that they're a national security agency. They're actually a cross between a secret society and a criminal syndicate. So that's what their entertainment liaison office is doing, is maintaining that deception. And so either they're denying that the CIA does bad things. So you have the films that are very positive depictions of the CIA, like Mission Impossible, for example. You know, no one dies in Mission Impossible films. No one gets tortured. No governments get overthrown. No people's deepest, darkest secrets get spread online in order to blackmail them out of revealing something about the CIA, so on and so forth. You don't get to see these things in those sorts of movies. But they also support movies like The Good Shepherd would be a good example, which show the dark side of the CIA, but help normalize it. They help justify it. They help tell us that, oh yeah, the CIA does do these things. They will, on occasion, throw a dissident out of a helicopter, but they're doing it for the sake of our safety, because it's a complex, horrible, hostile, dangerous world out there. And you know, like Jack Nicholson says, you want someone on that wall. You need someone on that wall. So aren't you glad, in fact, that there are some evil sociopaths called the CIA who are protecting us from the horrors of the Chinese or the Russians or the terrorists or the whoever, Venezuelans, take your pick, really. But what they say in public about what their entertainment liaison office does is much more benign and almost mundane. They just sort of say, oh, it's about ensuring accuracy. It's about ensuring that people understand what the CIA is really here for, and that, you know, we just want people to sort of get what we're all about. We just we want people to feel like we're sort of part of American society and so on. And it's like, well, yeah, on the face of it, actually, that is sort of what they're doing. But because they're lying about what the CIA is, because the CIA in general lies about what it is, that's reflected and projected onto the world at large via Hollywood. And let me give you an example. They supported the film The Courier two years ago now, this Benedict Cumberbatch movie, which is all about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Penkovsky Papers, the whole Penkovsky spy situation. Now, that film opens with a speech by Khrushchev that culminates in, where he's talking about the impressive Soviet nuclear arsenal, and he ends the speech with this line, "We will bury you." He never said that. Inasmuch as he said that line, it was actually at a meeting at an embassy between a bunch of diplomats where he was talking about the historic rivalry between the Soviet socialist system and the Western capitalist system, and was basically saying, we will win. The socialist system will, you know, in the annals of history, will win. He wasn't talking about nuclear weapons. So they've ripped that line completely out of context, slapped it into this movie, and the CIA have said, thank you very much. And then at the end of the movie, they deviate completely from historical reality in that they depict the CIA and MI6 trying to basically rescue Oleg Penkovsky from the Soviet Union. That never happened. It plain and simply never happened. It wasn't even planned. It wasn't even suggested. It wasn't even considered. So they managed to turn the Cuban Missile Crisis, something provoked by the CIA at the Bay of Pigs and with Operation Northwoods and all of that, they provoked the Cuban Missile Crisis. They managed to make it seem like, oh no, it was some horrendous, dastardly plot by those evil Russians, and we're the ones rescuing people. It's a complete inversion of reality. I'm ranting, sorry.
I don't think that was a rant. It's very good.
Okay, so they make these claims, and I thought the film does a really good job of, you know, pointing this out in various ways, that they make these claims that, as you said, they sound very mundane. They sound, you know, who could really object to it, where they basically say, oh, no, we're just about authenticity, right? Like, the only thing the Pentagon cares about when they're deciding whether or not to offer support to a big studio film is, like, you know, are the uniforms correct? Is the, you know, insignia right in the background? Or what? Like, that's all they really care about, when in reality, they've got all these other, you know, propaganda purposes going on. But
yeah, and to be clear, like, I mean, it is in their official documentation as well. This isn't just us overreading into what we think their intentions are. If you go down, and all the documentation is out on tomspyculture.com website, and it's in the documentary. You know, they do say, it's just they bury it in the small print. So it's things like, you know, that the narratives in these productions will not go against the interests of the US government, and, you know, very obvious things like that. So you can pick through. It's just that they're not inclined to say that sort of thing in interviews. It's like Phil Strub, when he was asked, you know, because he was, you know, asked a question about how powerful he was in the industry, and he said something like that he was like a He was like a eunuch in the court of Imperial China. Now, that's a very clear way of him trying to make it seem as though his role was very marginal. And maybe it's just that he's really modest as a person. Maybe modesty is his watchword. But more likely, and certainly the effect of it, is that, you know, that he probably is, you know, one of the most powerful people, or was until he recently retired, but probably was one of the most influential figures on any Hollywood script. You know, up there with the Sumner Redstones and the Rupert Murdochs and all of those people, like a kind of executive producer on hundreds of different productions in his during his tenure. So those kind of things are indicators, but including in the official documentation and in the contracts, of course, that all of these film producers have to sign as part of their agreements with the Pentagon. It's all done with legal oversight, with lawyers involved. So it's not like this is just some, you know, sort of a dusty old broom cupboard where they dole out, you know, they have an old guy in there who knows which way the ribbons go round on a military uniform. That's how it kind of could be. That's probably how it should be. That's probably what the Pentagon's office should be. It's just a couple of old vets who are like, yeah, this is what the kind of language we use. But it's not. It's an extensive, very slick, very 21st century PR machine, which is also very enthusiastic about the and able to operate well outside what you'd normally expect an organization to be able to do. You know, they're not selling breakfast cereal. They can get into everything, and they can provide huge items that are simply not available elsewhere, including things like helicopter gunships and aircraft carriers and things like that. So the amount of pull that they can have is absolutely tremendous. Yeah, I really think that, I mean, like I said, when I got to 2013-ish, I was basically ready to quit this, but I just thought it's incredible that the size and scale and level of secrecy just meant that I felt I had to keep on going with the project to unveil that. Yeah, that's how I feel about it, and that's how I feel about the scale and severity of it.
Yeah, you know what I thought of. Listening to what you guys just said is basically it sounds like these ELOs are doing the old Kaiser Soze move, right? The best trick is convincing the world that the devil ever did is convincing the world that he doesn't exist, right?
Exactly. And,
I'm just this like humble little guy in a you know, forgotten corner of the Pentagon, and you know, no one really listens to me. And
well, yeah. as Roger describes it at the start of the of our documentary, it makes it almost look like a broom cupboard, a kind of dusty old room, and then he opens up the door. But Roger's done really quite brilliant animated work in the film. I never realized he had that talent, but and then he kind of opens up the door and you see everything kind of come out of it, almost like a scene from Ghostbusters or something.
Well, and in terms of the scale of it, especially to jump on the back of that thing that Strub said about being a eunuch, which is a line that has always made me laugh. Mm-hmm. If we compare him to a major Hollywood producer, Strub was in that job for about 30 years, about 1988 to 2018 or so. And during that time, he worked on at least 6 of the top 10 movie franchises in the world.
Mm. At Jurassic least. Park. what can you remember what they were? Jurassic Park?
Well, it's things like James Marvel. Bond, Fast and Furious, the Marvel Universe, the DC Universe. I'm sure if you go down the list on Wikipedia, Transformers is another one. It's in the top 10. You know, these are the films.
Terminator.
Terminator. I mean, if you keep going down, it's like it's 6 or 7 of the top 10. It's 13 or 14 of the top 20. If you keep going down, it's just like the top 50 movie franchises. more than half of them will have been through some form of the Pentagon's filtering mechanism. And pretty much all of that happened while Strub was in office. What movie producer can say that? What movie producer can say, I've influenced, you know, 30 of the top 50 movie franchises in the world? I've reviewed their scripts. I've told them what they can and can't put in there. Who has that kind of influence in Hollywood? The answer is no one, actually. I haven't come across anyone, any producer, any director, even the, you know, even like a Christopher Nolan, you know, complete A-grade movie producer, writer, director. He doesn't influence that many products. He only really has influence over his own. Even someone like Spielberg, who's been an executive producer on dozens and dozens and dozens of films, even he hasn't reached that level of influence. So, yeah, Strub's simply lying about that, or as Matt said, is being pathologically modest. People can make up their own minds.
Can you be pathologically modest? It'd be great if you could. I mean, it's, I mean, I might be, but it's not for me to say.
You might think so. I couldn't possibly comment. Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, well, to me, aside from all the documentation you guys have uncovered, you know, the things in contracts and the internal documents and whatever, where they admit what they're really up to in large part, there's also the difference between, you know, what they will say publicly to the media or whatever about what they do, and then what you can actually see just from the evidence of which films, because the single most powerful thing they have is the decision over which films to support and which films not to support. Like that's the root of almost all of their power over the industry. And if, you know, the kind of exoteric face of what they do is, oh, we just care about authenticity and accuracy. Right. Well, then you got a real problem though, because they obviously have supported and continue to support all kinds of movies that have all kinds of, you know, inaccuracies and not authentic things. As I think Tom was already talking about before, like they'll completely just falsify actual historical films, you know, didn't make them be the opposite of what really happened. So there's that. Then there's all the just ludicrous over the top, the fact that they get involved with all these you know, superhero movies or wild sci-fi movies, the Terminator movies, all these different things. Like, really? That reflects you trying to make sure things are accurate and authentic? Is like, how would the Pentagon fight Godzilla? And then there's also the other issue that the film brings up, which, you know, I had known about from, you know, reading your guys' previous work and whatever, but I think the film really does a good job of digging into it, which is how often it is that the DOD will deny support to movies that are written, directed, or both by actual veterans. And, you know, even though if you get a bunch of independent veterans to go watch these movies, they'll say like, oh yeah, that was actually one of the most accurate, you know, war movies I ever saw. So if their main yardstick as to deciding what to support and what not to support is just, you know, accuracy and authenticity, you would think they'd be supporting veterans written and produced movies more than anything else.
Well, sure. Why are they rejecting Fields of Fire, which never got made? Platoon, written by a veteran, directed by a veteran. Born on the 4th of July, written by a veteran, directed by a veteran. Jarhead, based on a book by a veteran, written by another veteran. All of these were rejected because in some way they did not portray military life in a feasible fashion or some stupid line like that. Well, what does feasible mean in that context anyway? It's just one of those words they're using as a placeholder for saying we don't like this thing, so no. But they'll support Transformers 5, a movie about artificially intelligent giant extraterrestrial robots invading Earth. They'll support Godzilla. They'll support Jurassic Park movies. Well, none of those are any, by any metric, are more feasible or realistic or accurate depictions of the military, because none of those events happened. Whereas the events in all of those films written by veterans either happened or are fictionalized, dramatized versions of things that actually happened, that were actually seen by the people who wrote those movies. So
I think that they could actually legitimately say that there is a difference between supporting something that which is out and out fantasy, science fiction fantasy, and providing some support on that for for whatever reason, and them being obliged to support films that are taking a particular, having a particular take on history that they disagree with. I can see why there might be a distinction on that. I'm not too harsh on them for supporting Transformers or Godzilla in the sense that I don't think it's inappropriate for a neutral, non-propagandizing government organization to say, yeah, we're perfectly happy to lend our advice to a film about monsters. I don't think there's anything necessarily that wrong about that. It's just that the way that they do it, I think, is the thoroughly inappropriate. I mean, look, with a good example being that one of Godzilla, where they denuclearize the whole script because they don't even want to even allude to the bombing of Hiroshima, which was 70, can't even work up the maths of it, years ago. You know, so they rewrite the lines that are anything to do with Hiroshima. So it's like you can't have your cake and eat it. With their approach, I think it's completely wrong because you can't say that either these things are just fictional and so what, and anything can go in the script, or they are serious and. Do you see what I mean? I've explained that badly.
No, I know what you're saying. There's a big difference.
Trying to pace around like Sherlock Holmes so I can keep my mind clear. But actually, my cat keeps nipping at my ankles and the clothes dryer is on. So it's completely ruining my flow.
You've lost your mojo.
Yeah, I've lost my mojo. I'm trying to hide from the animal and the machine.
Well, another thing that the film brings up when it's talking about, the actual kind of nuts and bolts of the research that you guys have done, and I know this was something that, limited what you had access to for writing National Security Cinema versus what you had access to leading up to this film. Tell us a bit about the story of this guy, Lawrence Seward, because that is just such a bizarre, strange tale.
Okay. Well, actually, we've found more information on him since the film was completed. But at any rate, Larry Seward was perhaps the academic writing about this, the historian writing about the whole military Hollywood relationship for the better part of half a century. He was pretty much the only source that anyone went to. He was the only person considered especially credible. He was the only one really writing about it in any depth or beyond the odd newspaper or magazine article here or there. And then David Robb came along, this investigative journalist, and he managed, through a variety of methods, to actually see quite a lot of the paper trail that Seward had been working on all these years. And now this is documents that had come almost exclusively from the military themselves. When Roger finally got into Seward's archive, we'll get into the archives in a second, he discovered things like, essentially, Seward was just writing to either Phil Strub or Don Baruch, whoever was head of the Pentagon office at the time, and saying, oh, can I get the files on this? Do you have any paper trail on that? Oh, whatever. There was a whole bunch of stuff that the Pentagon was apparently just going to throw out. They weren't even going to send it over to the National Archives. They were just going to, junk it, chuck it in the shredder, whatever, that Seward also rescued. And this paper trail formed the basis of his books and also formed the basis of his archives at Georgetown University. Now, in the early 2000s, David Robb managed to get into at least one of those archives, and I think both of them. Now we've been able to reconstruct a lot of this. There's a lot of stuff in Robb's book that clearly came from the second, more private archive that essentially was just Seward's private, his own curated collection that only people could get into with his permission. And so Robb writes Operation Hollywood, which busts massive holes in everything Seward was saying, because Seward had been presenting this much like the Pentagon had presented this. Oh, this is just about accuracy. This is just about technical details and dialogue and people being the right rank. And basically the military is there to fix Hollywood's mistakes because Hollywood's full of dumbasses who don't know anything about the military. Even
they're
though,
all liberals, they're all left-wing, they're all anti-government, they're all anti-military, supposedly. But that's a bit of a myth in itself.
That's a complete myth in itself. If you follow the US Marine Corps Entertainment Liaison Office on Instagram, they are constantly posting about famous movie stars who are military veterans. Constantly. Virtually every post, it's like, oh, this movie came out, you know, 30 years ago today. The director was a military veteran, the lead actor was military, blah, 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 blah. So clearly that isn't even true anyway. But Seward very much played into that narrative of, oh, Hollywood's a bunch of, you know, liberal idiots who don't get the military. And Rob came along and said, no, this is a sophisticated propaganda operation. This is probably unconstitutional in various ways. And there is a whole bunch of stuff here about some of the most important themes and questions around the military that Seward has essentially just ignored. And this causes a massive falling out in the pages of an academic journal between the two of them. And then Rob, it seems, moved on to other things. And I don't think Seward really published that much after that. I think his second book, his other book came out in 2005, I think it was. But after that, he basically didn't publish anything for years. But during that time, people like, well, Matt being one of them, me being another, Trisha Jenkins, a handful of other people made contact with Seward saying, well, okay, since you're not publishing on this anymore, can we take a look at the papers in your archive? After all, they are government papers. They're not like your private personal correspondence or anything. And he'd always say no. I think he didn't want anyone doing another David Robb. I think he didn't want anyone else either, firstly, undermining his reputation and his credibility and his, I mean, I say credibility and integrity, he had none, but he had the appearance of those things. But he also didn't want people actually getting a good look at what this propaganda operation was up to. And so he acted as a gatekeeper to this information. We knew that much. We made some references to this in National Security Cinema. What we've discovered since then is that, firstly, this relationship between Seward and the DOD went back probably even longer than we thought it did. Secondly, that it was even closer than we previously realized, in as much as he was actually sharing parts of the transcript with Strub and Baruch, and they were giving him notes on it and making suggestions and saying, no, we'd rather you framed it in this way rather than that way, all of this kind of stuff. And actually, since the film came out, one of the other discoveries we've made is that Seward actually helped put together the DOD's Hollywood database. This database of maybe 800-900 productions, mostly ones that they worked on, but it also lists a bunch of rejections and other things. He actually helped put that together under contract from Strub's office. That's how close he was. And so we have to see Seward's books not as independent academic commentaries by a historian, but as PR efforts for that PR office itself.
Yeah, he was and paid for as well, at least indirectly, he was paid by those organizations.
Well, some of the time he was working under contract to them, and he was also recommended for like fellowships and, you know, money from various foundations, that sort of thing, to help him finish this project or continue with this project. Those recommendations were made by people within the Pentagon. So we have to see his books and the internal paper trail of the Pentagon not as separate things, you know? They are, to some extent, one and the same project that the Pentagon has been selling as this PR myth about what they're actually doing here, PR for their own PR operations, on the one hand, and Seward has been backing that up, seemingly as an outsider, seemingly as an independent, for decades, in order to continue and, you know, make that more plausible. And the whole thing's a lie, and the whole thing's a sham. And what we've now found through, I mean, both Matt and Roger have made visits to that Georgetown library to try and get a handle on, you know, what's actually there, what the hell's going on with all of this. Now Seward's dead. I'm not going to say fortunately. Fortunately, Seward is now dead. So people can actually get in there. They can actually look at those papers. And Roger has been in and made copies of a whole bunch of stuff, which otherwise would probably have never seen the light of day. Because it's not like anyone knew about any of this, besides people like me and Matt and Roger and a handful of other people who've like obsessed over this. So a whole bunch of things are now possible to prove, not just about what the Pentagon has been doing in Hollywood all these years, but how they've been shaping their own narrative about what they've been doing in Hollywood all these years. And Seward has played an absolutely critical role in all of that.
Yeah, and if I was to think back to the nature of academic study into this as well, into the nature of research into this whole field. I mean, Seward's been dominating, film studies as a discipline, as something that is in thousands of universities, or at least thousands of universities around the world. You know, the fact is that film studies has never really been very well integrated with politics and propaganda. And one of the reasons for that is because there hasn't been very much data on it. There's not been very much empirical information about it. And where there are courses that are taught on film and propaganda, it's all going back to the Nazis and the Soviets and blah, blah, blah. But Seward, the importance of Seward as a gatekeeper within that academic field has probably affected the nature of the discipline itself, of film studies, of media studies, and so on. And that's why I think that the work that we've got involved in is really important. And I hope I'm not saying that through any sort of blindsidedness of myself. I just think inherently it is really important, like, because it does involve the control. It's new information about the whole way that the media scape is dominated and controlled, and you can't get more fundamental than that.
Yeah, well, let me say that as somebody who, you know, personally had no involvement in making this film or anything like that, so hopefully that means I'm at least somewhat objective. I actually agree that this is really, really important stuff. And just to kind of give my perspective of why, ever since I started to come across your guys's work, I've been like, wow, this is actually one of the most important kind of research projects into recent events and shady government deeds going right now. And I've never been in the military. I came pretty close to joining back when I was wrapping up high school. I come from a family with a lot of military people in it, but for the last 15 years, I've been teaching history at a community college in, you know, fairly small town, North Florida, in what used to be until recently very fertile recruiting grounds for the U.S. military. And as a guy teaching college history, I lost track of how many veterans I had come through my classes, you know, on GI Bill money and whatever, you know, especially during the heyday of the war on terror wars and everything like that. And it bothered me personally. I have a very, you know, anti-war, anti-imperialist perspective on all these things. And one thing that I found was very interesting was all the many veterans coming through my class, the overwhelming majority of them were sympathetic to my perspective on these wars and what they're really all about. And it was only a very small minority of veterans who had actually seen combat who were like, you know, still drinking the imperial Kool-Aid of, oh, this is about defending freedom or whatever. And a lot of these very disillusioned, very cynical veterans who came through my classes after going off to these wars, you know, many of them had physical handicaps and things caused by their service. Many of them, you know, had various types of psychological issues and whatever. And, you know, I didn't ask all of them this question, but a lot of them would want to talk to me after class about different things and whatever. And I got the impression that other than, you know, many of them came from families with a lot of military people in their family tree, but I got the impression from talking to many of them that for a lot of them, probably the vast majority, the single biggest influence on them making the decision to join the military, other than their own, you know, personal family directly, was Hollywood. Mm-hmm. That, you know, this is a huge thing that recruits these people. And, you know, the one and then I'll throw back to you guys if you want to chime in on this. But the one kind of white pill I've seen lately is that U.S. military recruiting is way down and is like they're having to lower all their standards and they're still not getting enough recruits for what they want to do. And this is at a time where the American economy is in the crapper in a lot of ways. And usually that makes military recruitment go up. So and not only is recruitment way down in a bad economy, but also something you guys started the film off with, Maverick, right? Maverick is this giant box office smash But it seems like, unlike the first Top Gun movie, that hasn't really, you know, people are happy to go see it and, you know, maybe believe some of its messaging, but it's not actually translating into any noticeable increase in improvement. But that's sort of like my personal, just because I've known so many of the veterans of the recent wars, and I've seen, you know, what those wars have done to them. And I know that Hollywood is such a big part of getting people like that to think that, you know, going off to fight in Afghanistan is a good idea.
Yeah. Can I jump in there, Tom? I'm sure you've got something to say as well, but let me say a couple of things. One, and perhaps I don't say this enough, I am definitely not opposed to servicemen and women. I think that they're being given a raw deal. It's not really an area that I know that much about. But what I do know is that the military, the military brass are a different kettle of fish. But then even beyond that, the PR people who are working for the government are a different class in themselves. And a really good example of that is that film Fields of Fire, which was written by the Undersecretary of Defense, a Vietnam veteran, Jim Webb. And it was used at military training academies across the United States and was seen as a key text. And so everyone in the military, even in the military establishment, wanted that film, which was an extremely successful book in every imaginable way, wanted that book to be made into a film. But it was the PR people who put the kibosh on that. Even the Marines, the Marine office, wanted that to be made. But it was the central Strubs office in the Pentagon that prevented it from being made, because they have got their eye on the bigger goal, which is not just about recruitment. It's about ensuring that there's no threat of a good example, no threat of history being presented in a more reasonable fashion when it comes to the application of imperial violence. That's where the stopper really lies. I don't, you know, people in the military, they're doing their thing, and even military brass are, you know, they're going to be fine at some time. But you go higher up that level of power, closer to levels of unaccountable power, and closer to the commercialization, corporatization of power in the form of PR, and the more likely you are to get these sticking points, these gatekeepers who are going to be, you know, operating as the kind of worst of the worst. And that seems to me what's happened there. Tom, do you want to add to that?
Well, just on it's the recruitment thing is important. As to the effect of Top Gun Maverick, we don't actually know that yet. I mean, it would take at least another 6 months before we'd even see any numbers kind of filtering through. So I have no idea whether that film has been a recruitment success or not. But it isn't just about getting people into the military. It's about keeping them there. All of these documents don't just say recruitment, they say retention, because they also have a big problem in keeping people beyond their, you know, whatever their initial contract is that they sign. Once that's over, that person can just walk away. And there isn't an awful lot they can do to stop them from walking away. And it turns out an awful lot of people do that, because they realize, this isn't what I signed up for. This isn't the glamorous, sanitized, heroized image of military life that I saw in a Top Gun movie. This is actually kind of miserable, and deeply unpleasant and unsettling in certain ways, or just is kind of a, you know, a shit job. If you spent 2.5 years, I don't know, cleaning up after aircraft when you were sold on the idea of being a fighter pilot, I'm not surprised you quit. I'm not surprised you decide there's something better I can do with my life. There's something more interesting and engaging that I can do than this.
It's funny, that's what we've got Tony Scott saying, that, haven't we, in the documentary, where he says he's sort of joking about it, but he's like, you know, I've got to apologize to all these poor guys who we've shown Top Gun to, who think that they're going to be flying all these jets, and they are literally just cleaning stuff for years on end.
Scrubbing pipes in an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
In you know, 40 degree heat. Well, 40 degrees in an American wouldn't be that hot, but over here, trust me, in Europe, 40 degrees is hot. So yeah, it's also about trying to keep people in there. And you have to remember, what are the places that these films are often seen before we get to see them? They're seen on military channels on aircraft carriers. They're seen in screenings on military bases. They invite military people to the premieres quite often. You know, this is all about, on top of everything else, you also get to see movies before they've come out. And those movies are telling you, stay in the military.
Yeah, and that's why there's that interesting example of the Kevin Costner film, 13 Days, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis, where I think I'm right in saying the Pentagon, they didn't cooperate on the film, and it was because it was all based on tapes recorded in the White House, and so they couldn't claim that they had any disagreement over accuracy. The producers were actually doing the right thing there. But then, as part of that, they refused to show this military-based film on any of their bases. And of course, that can have a dent in profits as well for these film productions. So there are all sorts of little side benefits that come from working with the military, and there are costs. You are going to lose probably a few hundred grand if you decide to tell them to go stick it. And that's what happened in that case. It ended up being a really good film. It was independently sort of successful, but they probably lost out on some, they're lost out on a bit of cash there. They happened to do the right thing.
Well, and on a movie where the margins were probably quite small in terms of how much overall money you can make, an extra few hundred thousand dollars here from either directly or indirectly. I mean, all of those screenings on military bases and things, they also have a promotional effect. People talk to their friends outside the military and say, oh, yeah, I've already got to see the new Iron Man film. And yeah, it's like this. And it's like, you've got to go see it as soon as it comes out and all that kind of stuff. It helps with buzz. It helps with social media coverage, all of this sort of thing. It has an influence on all of that stuff. And so certainly on a movie like 13 Days, that will have had an impact on the bottom line, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's funny to think counterfactually what would have happened if they had gone with military support on that film. How much more cheesy would it have become? And how much more money would they have made on that? I think in the end, I can't remember the exact figure, it was something like 30 million or something that they made, which is probably quite successful but no big profit. But I wonder what kind of script that the military would have actually enforced. Would they have tried to glam it up, to ham it up with sort of with more instances of derring do, or do you think they'd have just cut out any of the things that were secret operations, like the U-2 plane crashing over Cuba? And do you think they'd have just chopped stuff out, or do you think they'd have added stuff in?
I think they would have cast someone more handsome as Curtis LeMay, because the guy they cast in that film is one pig-faced looking guy.
Yeah. Or would they have gone so far as to, as they have so often, completely rewrite and invert the history and have it so that, maybe the Kennedy brothers are like wanting to go to nuclear war, and it's actually the military brass who are like, hey, guys, that'd be bad. Don't launch an invasion of Cuba.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be that sounds outlandish, but that is completely possible. I mean, I'm just trying to think of the. It's not quite as stark and as an example as that, but just because it's a recent film, the asteroid film. Don't Look Up. That was seen as soon as it came out as this great liberal kind of left wing, challenging corporate power. And of course, I certainly enjoyed watching it, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie. And I thought it was, well done. But yeah, as soon as it came out, myself and Tom looked at the stayed waiting at the end for the credits, and we saw that the Department of Defense had been involved. No one was aware of that. No one had mentioned it anywhere in the press, and no one did. I still haven't seen any reference to that anywhere. But that's why, quite interestingly, that movie Don't Look Up doesn't have the military's trying to do the right thing to prevent the asteroid coming down. Now the character who plays the sort of military Yahoo guy is a bit of a bit crazy, but he's not terrible. No one's terrible in it, and it's the corporate influences and the political. It's the White House with Meryl Streep as the president it's those people who are the villains of this piece. But actually, the military is all bound up in that in the real world in terms of climate change and so on. So,
well, and isn't the underlying message of that movie ultimately, wouldn't it have been better if the military had just nuked the asteroid?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So that's not to say that the movie was bad. Sorry, the cat caught me again, right on the leg, right on the foot, right on the shin. On the shin, I shouldn't walk around wearing shorts. But yeah, it's just an example where of one of many thousands of examples of where the military is just able to declaw without anyone even noticing, just because they've been involved, you know, just on the quiet. And that will have just been a few lines through the script. And of course, we still don't have the documentation for that. I imagine that Tom, you'll have put in an application for that already, but that could take a year or 2 years to come through, or it could take over eight years, like the like when we asked for the material about was it Argo?
Yeah.
And eventually, and then but a few, whatever it was, a year or so ago, we got this a letter that was replying to something in our I'd written in 2012, very confusing. When I opened it up, and it was like emails from Ben Affleck. I thought, well, that's nice of you, Ben. Why have you printed out your emails and sent them to me from 8 years ago? And then I realized it was an old, very, very old FOIA request that had been finally dealt with by the CIA. So, there are all sorts of levels of institutional secrecy, but also institutional slowness that means it's hard to know exactly what's happening on some of the latest products, and that shouldn't be the case.
Of the people that you got to comment on the film, I think probably the biggest name was Oliver Stone. So that was really cool and impressive that you got him to participate. And also, I'm trying to remember. What was it that Roger presented him with? Was it the rejection of support?
Yeah, it was Platoon.
It Platoon or yeah. One of his other movies? Yeah, and it's really telling where, I mean, Oliver Stone, obviously a guy who, you know, is unlikely to ever get ELO support for any of his films, and certainly hasn't ever so far. One of the few big, Hollywood directors who's actually made some big war movies and things that, take a line that the Pentagon doesn't like. But even for somebody like Oliver Stone and a guy who is, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but a guy who's, much more open-minded to conspiracy theories and things like this than most people in Hollywood, that even Oliver Stone was kind of surprised by some of what you guys, presented him with as far as how these people operate and how far their reach is. It's not exactly a question, I guess, but what was it like to kind of, first off to get to work a little bit with Oliver Stone, get him to comment for the documentary, but also, what was it like to see that even he was sort of surprised by just how far this stuff goes?
Yeah. I mean, I think, my involvement with that came from trying to remember how it exactly began, but I seem to remember having lunch in town, I think, and he just sent me an email in response to something that I'd sent to him or to one of his co-workers, years ago. Anyway, he eventually replied and said that he wanted to be involved, and I arranged this interview with him. But this was at the height of the pandemic, and so I got as far as Heathrow Airport and couldn't actually get to the States in the end, which was a rather crushing moment of my research career. But yeah, he was he had recommended, I think, mine and Tom's book. Was that right? Am I right in saying that he recommended?
Yeah,
the
mentioned
book?
National Security Cinema in a few places.
He recommended it to Louis Theroux, didn't he?
Yeah.
And on one or two of his other interviews that he was doing around the time, because he was promoting his autobiography around about 2020 and 2021. And so, yeah, he was endorsing our work. And then Roger went out, rather than myself and Roger, to interview Oliver in Los Angeles at his home. And yeah, I mean, I think Roger was expecting that Oliver Stone would know some, would know a fair bit about this you know, Operation Hollywood or whatever you want to call it, this propaganda apparatus. But no, I mean, Oliver Stone was kind of referring to our book to as the kind of revelations to Roger. I think it's just very difficult if you're, you know, if you're someone like him, you're already, you know, you're only an individual. And so unless you've actually done this this research systematically, it is very difficult to know. I mean, it's an indication. It's an indication of how impoverished the field is of political communication in film. It's an indication of that's why our book sold so well. I mean, I always thought that was interesting that mine and Tom's book in 2017, we had no advertising. We had we self-published because we just couldn't be asked to work with anyone. Tom did the front cover himself. It was the most no frills book you could imagine. We may as well have printed it on a carton of orange juice. But we put it out and there was just this huge thirst for it. And so we ended up selling many thousands of copies in the first 2 or 3 years. And I think it's an indication that there was nothing out there like that. And so there was nothing even for someone like Oliver Stone to have been able to latch onto over these past few decades.
Well, and on top of that, we should add in all of the tens of thousands of people who downloaded it for free, because as soon as that book, the ebook version of National Security Cinema, was up, it got cracked and was available on file sharing networks.
Oh, you've never told me that. Are you kidding?
within 5 days.
Why haven't you shut that down?
I'm not the NSA.
Oh, well, look, ask them. Can't believe.
And besides, I do also believe in like books being free. I mean, I download books for free, so really? I can't really complain at other people downloading my book for free. It probably helped, Matt, let's face it, because lots of people will have bought the paperback because they couldn't stand reading the shonky PDF cracked version.
Fine. Well, the movie's out now, and the movie is brilliant, and the movie's up to date. And also, I do think it's important that one of the things that was so unusual about the movie project is that, you know, usually the research is done prior to the shooting. You know, that kind of preparation documentation is done. But Roger was doing two jobs at once here. He was doing his own research project. I think because he felt a little bit, I still think it's just my theory. I think he was a bit jealous of me and Tom doing the book in the first place. But at the same time, he was also doing a filmmaking project and also doing that filmmaking project with really fairly high quality animation and graphics packages and so on. So I think Rogers really brought that. When I say he was doing a research project at the same time as filmmaking, I mean he was going around to archives. He was acting like the professor that he is, and he was also doing interviews as well. So it was a really unusual project. I mean, I'm quite surprised that he didn't have a nervous breakdown doing that. I think he's just quite a stable guy, isn't he? And so so he was able to handle it. But the story really is brought up to date. So it is better to watch the film than it is to buy National Security Cinema from 2017, which I understand is easily rip-offable from the internet anyway these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I've sent it for free to lots of people. So.
Nice one.
Was there anything in all the stuff that you got access to, you know, for the first time much more recently, particularly the Suet archives, was there anything in there? I know a lot of it for sure simply confirmed and illustrated a lot of suspicions you guys already had about, you know, what had gone on. But was there anything that you've come across so far in that stuff that was like really surprising or counterintuitive or anything like that?
I mean, that's the sort of question people often ask me in these kinds of interviews. And the problem is so much of it, you know, we're talking about tens of thousands of pages of material covering every conceivable aspect of this, really. So, I mean, like, stuff that surprised me. Certainly, there's a lot that's amused me. When I stumbled across, I think it was in the file on Crimson Tide, the 1990s nuclear submarine movie, which got rejected because it's about a mutiny on board of a US Navy nuclear submarine. That when that news got out, the Navy's office actually did an interview with LA Times, someone like that, some big LA publication. And as part of the question and answer session, the guy actually said, oh, no, we don't ask for script changes. He actually said that. Wow. Which is astonishing because his name is on documents literally dated weeks earlier where he's asking for script changes. I mean, that's the degree to which they will lie about this. So stuff like that both sort of raises my eyebrows and makes me laugh. I guess in all of this stuff, there is another example that I particularly liked. It's on a movie that was never made called Second to None. This was in the early 90s. The Marine Corps basically commissioned this movie. Because they wanted to show off the Harrier jump jet, which they got to do a couple of years later in True Lies. They were very big on getting the Harrier jump jet into True Lies. They loved that. But they'd commissioned this movie, which is all about the Marine Corps taking on some gang of pirates in Thailand or something like that. The script was originally called Thai Pirates. And one of the scenes that they objected to in this script that they themselves had commissioned was a scene where Marine Corps pilots start dumping human feces onto these pirates. And it's like, you know, from the minds of Hollywood, from the mind of Michael Bay or whatever. But, you know, stuff like that, where you just think, how on earth does this happen? I mean, firstly, why on earth is the Marine Corps commissioning their own movie in Hollywood? Secondly, why are they then complaining about a script that they asked someone else to write? I mean, did they just pick the wrong screenwriter or something? And then it turns out the movie was never made in the end because it started to run into a few financial troubles. And then the Gulf War kicked off and the military basically turned around and said, oh, no, no, we're too busy fighting this war now. We can't make this movie anymore. And it's just like the whole thing is kind of a dark farce. You know, it's weird that the military would be there in Hollywood commissioning this movie script and then complaining about the thing that they themselves had created and then not making it because they were too busy doing the thing that they're actually supposed to be doing, even though that thing is awful, you know?
Sounds like a combination of, Argo meets Tropic Thunder, yeah. But for real.
Yeah, it's like a Coen Brothers movie or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing that definitely surprised me, and, you know, I had already, I think you guys had mentioned it a little bit in National Security Cinema, and I know I've heard Tom talk about it on his podcast, but the degree to which when they get involved in television, it's not just the things you would expect, like, you know, TV series that depict the military or depict the CIA as like the centerpiece of the show, or, you know, the kind of weapons porn, quote unquote, documentaries that like History Channel used to run all the time or whatever. But it's even these sort of silly things where they'll get involved with like some random reality show that seems to have nothing to do with the military or the CIA or whatever. And as the film, you know, one of the things that cracked me up is like, what the hell is it with these people in cake shows? Like what made them decide that cake shows are a great venue to propagandize people for?
Well, the whole cake obsession goes back apps. I mean, that goes back to the days of Don Baruch. One of the things that Roger found in the Baruch archive in Don Baruch's files were all these pictures of the office back in the 50s and 60s when, you know, Baruch was kind of at the heyday of making war films. And they kept, there's loads and loads of pictures of them eating cake. Absolutely tons of, I don't know why this is. I don't know why those pictures were kept in the archives either, but obviously they're amusing. So I think cake is a psychological fixation for entertainment liaison officers. There is something to that, but it is more seriously, it's about reaching audiences that you wouldn't otherwise reach. I mean, who, the audience for a Transformers film and the audience for Top Chef or Cake Boss are very different. There isn't a huge amount of overlap. If you want to reach all of those people and recruit them all, either as actual recruits in terms of service members or as they call them, advocates, i.e. people who believe the schlock that they're selling them, then you have to try and reach all of them, which means you have to try and work on everything from Iron Man to Operation Christmas Drop. You know, so that's why they're involved increasingly in reality TVs, because it's a whole like audience demographic that they don't reach through the conventional stuff. I mean, women are a big part of that, but it's not just about that. It's about, like, how do you turn perhaps the parents of someone who was in the military and they were skeptical about them joining, but then they start watching their favorite reality shows and they're full of all of this pro-military messaging and all of these nice scenes depicting military life in, you know, quite a fun, sunshiny way. They're going to feel a bit better about that. They're perhaps not going to continue having those difficult conversations with their kid about, you know, I'm not happy with you signing up. I mean, are you going to leave after your 2-year stint is done or whatever? If those conversations go away, that helps retention. You see, the whole thing all feeds into one another. It's a mass psychological manipulation exercise on a global scale, essentially.
Yeah, you know what that makes me think about? When I teach my U.S. history courses at my day job and I cover World War II, I do get heavily into the various propaganda cranked out during World War II and World War I for that matter. And I show students clips, I'm sure you guys have seen these, of some of the propaganda cartoons put out during World War II for children, right? The Looney Tunes and so forth. And, you know, I ask them, why would you bother creating propaganda for 5-year-olds during World War II? Like, no one thought that the war would still be going in 13 years when those 5-year-olds were old enough to go join the military. Like, what's going on? And then I kind of throw out there, if none of them, you know, suggests it as a possibility, well, you know, a 5-year-old in 1943 is unlikely to ever serve in World War II, but he might have an older brother, a father, whatever, who's serving in World War II. And, like, let's say he's on a B-29 crew firebombing Japanese civilians. Well, you know, when your father or your older brother or whatever comes home from the war, you might ask uncomfortable questions like, hey, when you dropped firebombs on those civilians, like, did you burn children to death or whatever? And, you know, if instead you've been given like Looney Tunes cartoons that dehumanize the Japanese or whatever the case may be, then you're much less
Bugs
likely
Bunny
to ask
says,
those questions.
Don't ask about the firebombs. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You're just going to, you were firebombing those little Jap monsters. Right. Aside from which, then, you know, that kid may eventually be old enough to fight in Korea or Vietnam. So I guess there's that.
There is that. There is, I mean, these days they're going even younger than that. There was something I came across in the most recent batch of Navy documents where they were working with a YouTube-based show that's aimed at toddlers. Literally 2 to 3-year-olds.
Wow.
That's a slap in the face. You want to talk about stuff that surprises you when you read through these documents. That was one that took me aback a little.
I knew that
YouTube had started to be militarized about 10 years ago. They first really started engaging with YouTube. But that's like, toddlers shouldn't even be having to think about that kind of stuff. And they're not. Let's face it. If they were left alone to their own devices, they'd be thinking about eating mud and chasing snails and stuff. That's all 2 to 3-year-olds are really concerned with. They should not be getting militarized messaging in their goddamn YouTube show. They just shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's insane. One more thing I wanted to ask about that Theaters of War didn't get into, but I'm just curious as somebody observing it in recent years, is kind of any thoughts or anything that you've come across in documents or whatever about the recent turn in recent years of military and the CIA increasingly incorporating, for lack of a better term, woke messaging and imagery into their PR, because when you look at even the direct PR of those institutions, like not the stuff they're doing, you know, they're laundering through Hollywood, but, you know, if you look at the military's official social media accounts, things like that, you know, there was that kind of famous, the United States military Twitter tweeted some woke tweets at the start of Pride Month. And there was the famous a year or two ago, whenever it was, Humans of CIA videos that are, you know, where they have various CIA employees who check enough diversity boxes talking about how woke and whatever the CIA is as a place to work. What's going on there? Is it really just as simple as cynically trying to kind of, you know, pink wash and black wash and rainbow wash or whatever it is, and you know, deflect criticism? Or is there more going on behind that?
I think the answer to that is yes, there is more to it than simply, I mean, everyone at the start of Pride Month who is on social media starts posting rainbows for some reason. Everyone took down the Ukraine flag and just started hung a fucking rainbow flag in its place. That's a standard thing that happens pretty much every year now. I don't know if we should read too much into the military and CIA jumping on that sort of bandwagon, because it's just social media stuff anyway. But yeah, there is a, it's not just about trying to pink wash or rainbow wash fairly bigoted, marginalizing institutions. It is about that. It's also about reaching recruitment potential in demographics they would otherwise struggle to reach, partly because they are such bigoted institutions. And again, it's about trying to reach people as advocates. It's about trying to change hearts and minds. You know full well the CIA isn't actually interested in recruiting working class blacks from Baltimore, right? Because those kids don't have the education that's required for the CIA to do the things the CIA need them to do. I mean, except in a few certain circumstances. But what they don't want is that kid seeing them with hostility, with going on about how the CIA were behind the crack epidemic and so on and so forth. And so they will stick a bunch of, I guess, friendly faces into these products, and they will support products that are have a tendency to do that sort of thing. And they will even be going on their own completely ad hoc, unofficial promotional effort around Black Panther in order to change hearts and minds. Because they know there's a lot of people in these various demographics who don't like them. So it's not just about, like I said, there's something beyond like pink washing. It's not just about sort of saying, oh, we're gay friendly. It's about trying to get people who would otherwise be skeptical or hostile towards you to think of you in a fundamentally different way, or at the very least, just take the edge off, take that hostility away. If they're not actively militating against you, that's a win for them. If people just become apathetic towards the CIA as just another part of the government, that's a win for them.
Let alone,
so I think it's about that too.
Let alone if they can convince you to see them as, to use their own terminology, a quote unquote ally.
For sure, for sure. But it's also about, I mean, Foucault wrote about this. One of the problems with people who have been pushed to the fringes, pushed to the margins, is that they often seek validation from the very system that's done that to them, from the very categories in the system of values that's done that to them. Is that not what Hollywood is actually kind of facilitating now? Is that it's saying, like, there was a cartoon that came out on Netflix last year, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was last year, last summer, which is all about a bunch of gay and trans and what have you characters who work for the CIA, and they are marginalized and not taken seriously. And the whole plot, the whole like emotional arc of the series is about them being taken seriously, wanting to be taken seriously by the CIA. You see what I mean? They're judging themselves by the very organization that's abused them.
Right.
And they want, they're seeking validation from their own abuser. And that's, I mean, actually a fairly common thing, I guess, in this world for people to do, but it's certainly something Hollywood has instrumentalized, and these organizations have then weaponized as a tool for messing with these people's heads and making them feel like, yeah, yeah, we've treated you badly, but you should still worship us, and you should still want us, you know, you should still want us to see you as a good person, as a valid person. And in fact, we're the authority you're supposed to be looking up to, even as we slap you around the face. And if you can get people to that point, I mean, Jesus, that's, it's horrifying, but it's astonishingly effective.
I would add to that to say that, and I don't know whether you'd class this under the kind of woke spinning or woke politics or whatever, but if you go back, say, 15, 20 years about the recruitment of women in the CIA, and that's when I think they realized that they had quite a problem of lack of diversity and therefore lack of skills in the Central Intelligence Agency. And so that's when they recruited Jennifer Garner, for example, to do unpaid advert. So she was married at the time to Ben Affleck, and then she became the character Sydney on the long running TV series Alias, which then, you know, kind of inspired, I guess, Carrie's character in Homeland, and so that lots of these instead of having just old, you know, old blokes doing it, Roger Moore types, which would have been in the any time up to the sort of 80s or even 90s, that started to change around that point. The other thing I would also mention is I think that there's a broader thing going on. If you look at the war in Ukraine, I did an article a couple of months ago, just near the start of the war, which was called Liberal Derangement and US Foreign Policy. And I do think this isn't directly tied to Hollywood, but I do think that there is these narratives about a kind of the sort of hyper liberal world order do play into these ideas of wokeism, and that's what the establishment is kind of sort of militarized establishment is utilizing that. But I haven't seen, I don't know so much about the specifics of how that's been weaponized from Hollywood over the last 2 or 3 years, but Tom's pointed to some of that.
Yeah, it seems like it might be useful if there's people who wouldn't be amenable to a war, let's say, against a Middle Eastern country to take natural resources. But what if you could convince them that such a war is actually really about trying to protect, you know, fill in the blank gay rights or whatever in that country?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a point just a couple of years ago where, you know, the head of the CIA and the head of various different arms companies were all female. And so that creates this impression that there is something progressive inherently about authority structures in the West. And of course, then you've kind of got this classic stale, pale male Vladimir Putin, who's this kind of dark looking creature in the Kremlin, the kind of representative of the kind of old world. You know, he's stuck somewhere in about 1981 on gay rights, and he's kind of got a younger mistress, and it's all shrouded in mystery, and he's still emphasizing his nuclear weapons. You know, we don't even talk about our nuclear weapons anymore, because they're like, no, that's a bit dirty, isn't it? It's like this clash between East and West, which is currently embodied in the currently manifesting in Ukraine, but could well become something bigger in the South China Sea as well. But this clash between East and West is between kind of these enlightened, liberal, diverse values, all of which are promoted directly or indirectly by Hollywood and this lovely light entertainment scene. And these kind of dark, backward, primitive peoples who are still kind of, you know, a part of that kind of shady world, this sort of orientalist world. I mean, I'm saying that obviously skeptically and ironically, because it's a load of nonsense, really. But, you know, that those kind of narrative threads are a constant part of the way that our societies, our global societies, are set up. And it's those narrative threads are the kind of, you know, the streams that that lead into the ideological rivers that mean that the planet is so divided. So and Hollywood is not helping with that. None of the media systems are helping with that, apart from TikTok. And you should check out my TikTok.
All right. Well, it's been great talking to you, Matt, Tom. I appreciate your time. I very much appreciate the film. I heartily recommend it. I would love to see it get as wide of a viewership as possible. Anything else that either of you would like to throw in? Anything we didn't mention that you'd like to mention about the film, or anything you want to plug?
Please, can I say one thing? I don't want to plug anything. I want to mention, don't extradite Assange. Please go to any website to do with don't extradite Julian Assange, because that's important. And that's coming up as a possibility for the head of WikiLeaks, the founder of WikiLeaks, to be completely screwed over by basically tyrannical systems. On the 8th of October, we're going to be holding hands around the British Parliament as a form of protest against that. Please do join in that in any way you can.
Sure, absolutely. I would second anybody doing anything they can on that front, for sure.
Well, and just to tie it all together, in terms of the last point you made, I mean, yeah, I totally agree. What on earth is he even being extradited for? That whole situation is clearly such an insane attack on critical, skeptical media. But remember, back in the day, WikiLeaks published a CIA memo where they were talking about rebranding the war in Afghanistan as a war for women's rights.
Oh, great. Yeah.
That was over a decade ago. How do you think women's rights are in Afghanistan right now? better or worse?
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And also bear in mind that, you know, the WikiLeaks issue is something that was made into several Hollywood movies, all of which were pretty disgraceful in terms of the way that they smeared Assange himself. Just to clarify to any listeners who aren't aware, he's currently in Belmarsh Prison, which is the highest security prison in Britain, and is threatened with extradition to the United States, where he would, I can't remember the name of the prison now, but it would be maximum security for 175 years. And this is all based purely on the US government's case against him for the 2010 documentation leaks, which were all about war crimes, not even about the Hillary Clinton leaked emails. They've abandoned bothering to do anything about that. Nothing to do with any sexual case, which is a load of nonsense anyway, that they've long since dropped. And it is an assault on media freedom, but also an assault on an innocent individual and a family. There's a new movie that's actually come out, because you can still sometimes get independent films made that go through independent channels. It's called Ithaca, and it stars Julian's wife, who's absolutely brilliant, and his father. And it follows their journey over the last 3 or 4 years. It's worth watching, and you'll get a lot out of that film. I hasten to say that it cannot really be called entertainment, but I think you'll find it a very I think you'll get a lot out of it emotionally and in terms of knowledge if you go and watch Ithaca, which is around in independent cinemas throughout the United Kingdom at the moment, and I think elsewhere, but see where you can see it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out. I wasn't aware of that one. Well, anyway, it's been great talking to you, Matt. Great talking to you, Tom. Again, thanks very much for your time and for the many years of work you both have, you know, been doing and are continuing to do on this very important topic.
Thanks.
All right, and I just want to say thanks again to Matt and Tom for their time and for all of their work, really, not just on this film, but all the work the two of them have done in researching and exposing this propagandistic, unholy relationship between the Pentagon, CIA, FBI, etc., and big entertainment productions. And again, I would ask that if you like my work and want to help support it and help me ramp it up to new levels, please now more than ever consider either kicking into the Indiegogo while it's still up and running, and or signing up for monthly contributions. And, you know, I'm going to be able to do more than I was able to before of things just for supporters of the show, like special bonus episodes, etc. like that. So all the more reason, aside from just you want to help me out personally and bring down my level of terror and apprehension slightly, because to say that I'm a mixed bag, including a lot of anxiety right now, is quite an understatement. But anyway, thank you for listening. And again, please go watch Theaters of War. It's a great documentary film about all this stuff we've been talking about, and it's very much worth watching. It's also a very good one to share if you've got someone who's completely, you know, clueless about this relationship and how much of what comes out of, you know, big entertainment company studios is actually state-influenced or even controlled propaganda. So take care, and I'll talk to you all soon.